One of my favorite pictures that I have hanging up across the street in the rectory is a photograph of St. John Paul II embracing St. Teresa of Calcutta. And under that picture of those two saints together is a quote from Mother Teresa, where she said, "God calls upon us not to be successful, but to be faithful." God calls upon us not to be successful, but to be faithful, which is somewhat different than our human ambitions, because we would prefer to be the leader of the pack. We would prefer to be at the head of the class. And yet Mother Teresa, who was so humble and holy, was very much an imitation of Christ, who said, "The first will be last, the last will be first, and the least shall become the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." If God gave you a task, and you knew it was going to be very unlikely that you would be successful at it, would you still be faithful to it? That was the question put to Ezekiel in the first reading today. God tells him to go to a rebellious people and call them to repentance and to tell them to return to covenant faithfulness. But he told them, because they're rebellious, they're not going to listen to you, but you have to go anyway, so that they will still have that opportunity to accept or reject God's hand and friendship, and they will know that there was a prophet in their midst. Ezekiel set out on this task, knowing that it was going to be difficult, knowing that they weren't going to listen or change, and yet he was all in, completely and totally committed to fulfilling this task, because he believed that it came from God and that God's will was superior to his own. Ezekiel was preaching to God's chosen people 600 years before the birth of Jesus, and it was a time of great brokenness among the Jewish people. There had already been a civil war 3 centuries before that split their little country in two, where there was the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. You put the two together and it was only about the size of New Jersey. And yet the Jewish people felt at a great disadvantage. They knew how small they were compared to the countries around them who had more territory, who had bigger and better armies and armaments, and who also had more gods than they did. And therefore, God's chosen people began to wonder, if other countries have so many gods to save and to protect them, perhaps the reason why we fail is because we only have one, where others have so many. And thus, for centuries, generation after generation of the Jewish people went to Jerusalem and offered incense and sacrifice in the temple, dedicated to the one God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But they were also moonlighting in other temples, erected and dedicated to lesser gods, offering incense and sacrifice all over the place, that whether there be one God or many gods, somebody might save them in their time of affliction. When God made his covenant with Israel and Judah, it was a marriage vow. "You will be my people. I will be your God." He expected them to be faithful to him because he was being faithful to them. When they proved to be unfaithful, he was as disappointed as you might be if you found that your spouse had been unfaithful to you. But God never divorced them. He never withdrew his covenant from them. Instead, he continued to send them patriarchs and judges and prophets with the same message. "You have an opportunity to repent. You have an opportunity to return to me, and we will renew our marriage vows with each other." And yet generation after generation continued to be stiff-necked and hardened of heart. And in so many cases with those patriarchs, judges, or prophets, when the Jewish people did not like the message, they wanted to shoot the messenger. And Ezekiel, like so many others, endured great rejection and wouldn't be considered a great success because the people did not listen, they did not change, and thus broke out a great war with Babylon and the armies of King Nebuchadnezzar. And their temple would be destroyed, their homes would be taken from them, it would ruin their lives and their livelihood, and the men would go off to work as slaves in exile for 3 generations. But they knew that a prophet was in their midst who accepted the fact that he was going to be faithful, even if he wasn't going to be successful. Paul the Apostle, he had similar experiences. Today we're listening to the 12th chapter of his second letter to the Corinthians. In the previous chapter, he goes into great detail about how much suffering he had to endure while in service to the gospel. In 2 Corinthians 11, Paul talks about how many times he was whipped with cords, had stones thrown at him, was thrown in the jail, shipwrecked, and left for dead. And yet he summed that all up with this: we must be willing to bear our fair share of hardships for the gospel. No matter how much Paul suffered in service to the church, he believed that Jesus suffered more. And he also believed that in his previous life as Saul of Tarsus, the Pharisee, he caused greater suffering than he had to endure when he was persecuting the church instead of trying to protect it and preserve it and advance its cause. And now today he speaks about what he really feels is holding him back. He calls it a thorn in the flesh. That lest he become too elated and boast too much and be proud, this thorn in the flesh is keeping him humble and holy, making him trust in the Lord. He never defines it for us. Was it gambling? Was it drunkenness? Was it some sort of immoral, impure thought or action? Or was it just an annoying person that won't leave him alone? Whatever it was, this thorn in the flesh was a drag on Paul's sails. He said, it's like an angel of Satan sent to beat me, and three times I begged the Lord to remove it. But the Lord never said yes, and he never said no. His answer was different. He said, my grace is enough for you, Paul. And that is the same answer the Lord tells to us when we feel that sin, vice, faults, failings, whatever the case may be, thorns in our flesh are keeping us from doing God's will. We want him to take care of it. We want him to get rid of it, or them, whatever the case may be. And he doesn't say yes. He doesn't say no. He says, my grace is enough for you too. Because from before he knit us together in our mother's womb, God believes that he already gave us all the tools that we need in our toolbox in order to overcome those crosses, in order to have those thorns become one day for us the crowns of glory. We just have to persevere and keep at it, being faithful even when we are not successful. Jesus too would experience the same hardship. We like to think of him as always surrounded by people who believed in him and wanted to leave everything and follow him. But the longer Jesus was out there preaching and teaching and working miracles, he wasn't just being followed by fans. He was also being followed by foes. We see in the 6th chapter of Mark, the first critics lining up against Jesus, and it's an unexpected source. In Mark chapter 6, Jesus comes back to Nazareth for the first time since his baptism and the beginnings of his ministry. When he left, he was just a humble, poor carpenter's apprentice. But now they've heard news of him that they did not expect. He's been able to cast out demons. He's been curing the sick. He was able to make a paralyzed man move again. In the previous chapter, he raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. Jesus comes home. He goes into the synagogue where he was revered as a rabbi because of his vast knowledge of the scriptures, which he as God helped to write. And yet when he proclaims himself as a Messiah, they say, who is this? Where does he come from? By whose authority does he do these things? And Mark tells us they took offense at him. They took offense at him. They've known him from the time he was a baby. But because now he has a power that is out of this world, they want to keep him at arm's length. They're not so sure that this is the Jesus they knew and grew up with. But if we read that same account of this story of Jesus' homecoming in the 4th chapter of Luke, they were more than offended. Not only did they cast him out of the pulpit and cast him out of the synagogue, the people of Nazareth took him to a cliff and wanted to throw him off it. They were so threatened by Jesus' power, they would rather he be killed. That didn't look like success for Jesus. It was hard going. The longer he preached, more groups were aligning themselves against him. By the time he finally made it to the cross, there was the Sanhedrin, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, the scholars of the law, the Herodians, and the Romans. All these groups that hated each other, but they hated Jesus more and joined forces against him because he posed a threat to their power over the people, because he came to set us free from the oppressions of this world, from the oppressions of sin, Satan, and death, and they didn't like it, and they tried to stop it. Jesus knew from before he came from heaven to earth how it was going to end. He knew what God was asking him to do. And to many, him dying on that cross, that didn't look like victory. That didn't look like the succeeding of God's plan. It looked like an epic failure and a crushing defeat of his mission. But he was determined to be faithful, even when it looked like he wasn't successful. And that's how he turned that cross, his darkest hour, into his finest hour. And a great time of trial and tribulation becomes a triumph for him and for all who believe in him. We've seen this countless times throughout history, my friends. People who are willing to do hard things because they are the right things, knowing that they may never come back. That explains all the combat veterans who have made that ultimate sacrifice for our flag and our freedom in countless battles and fields, foreign and domestic, over the 245 years of America's history. That's what we celebrate this day. The freedom isn't free. not our freedom from sin and death. That came at the precious cost of Jesus' precious body and blood shed for us on the cross. And freedom from tyranny, that came with the blood, sweat, and tears of countless patriots who died the future generations of Americans may be free. But what about when it all began? On July the 4th, at Mass, I always like to share the story of those who signed the Declaration of Independence that said to the British Crown that we no longer want taxation without representation. We will chart our own course in history. We choose to be free. Have you ever wondered about what happened to the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence? Five signers were captured by the British as traitors and tortured until death. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. 2 lost sons in the Revolutionary Army. Another 2 had sons taken as prisoners of war. 9 of those 56 fought and died from wounds or hardships of the Revolutionary War. These men signed and pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor that we might be free. But what kind of men were they? 24 were lawyers, 11 were merchants, 9 were farmers, all of them men of means and well-educated. But they signed the Declaration of Independence knowing full well that the penalty would be death if they were captured. Carter Braxton of Virginia, a wealthy planter and trader, saw his ship swept from the seas by the British Navy. He sold his home and properties to pay his debts, and he died penniless. Thomas McKean was so hounded by the British that he was forced to move his family constantly. He served in the Continental Congress without pay, and his family was kept in hiding. His possessions were taken from him, and poverty his only reward. Vandals and soldiers looted the properties of signers Dillery, Hall, Clymer, Walton, Gwinnett, Hayward, Rutledge, and Middleton. At the Battle of Yorktown, Thomas Nelson Jr. noted that the British General Cornwallis had taken over the Nelson home for his headquarters. Thomas Nelson Jr. quietly urged General George Washington to open fire on his house. The home was destroyed, and Nelson died bankrupt. Signer Francis Lewis had his home and properties destroyed. The enemy jailed his wife, and she died within months. John Hart was driven from his wife's bedside as she was dying. Their 13 children fled for their lives. John Hart's fields and his gristmill were laid to waste, and for more than a year he hid in forests and caves, returning home only to find his wife dead and his children vanished. So take a few moments today while enjoying your 4th of July holiday and silently thank these patriots. It's not too much to ask for the price they paid. They remind us that freedom is never free, and we thank these 56 early patriots, as well as those patriots fighting even now to protect our flag and our freedom.